will continue this evening by first completing our saga of the first temple. And this means the temple, in whatever form it existed and it evolved up until the time of its destruction by the Babylonians. Then afterwards, we're going to begin the long and profound chapter 8 of 1 Kings, because it revolves around the initial dedication of Solomon's temple so that services of worship to Jehovah could begin within it. Now, we're taking the time at this point to follow and sum up the history of the first temple because it plays such an important role in defining the context for the history of Israel. And the history of Israel over the next several hundred years had everything to do with the character and actions of a long series of Israelite kings, both good and wicked ones, who ruled over a fractured promised land. And the nature of their leadership was always visibly manifested in their attitude towards the temple and towards the priesthood in Jerusalem. Now, recall from our previous lesson that within a few years after King Solomon's death, Israel fell into a civil war. They divided back into the more historically traditional northern and southern coalitions of tribes, and therefore what was for 80 years a single united kingdom of God with one king over all the tribes and tribal territories was now two separate kingdoms, each with their own monarch. So as we discuss these two kingdoms of Israel, or as the Bible often calls them, the two houses of Israel, first, understand that these two kingdoms came into being very quickly after Solomon's death. And second, that the name for the southern kingdom was Judah, the name for the northern kingdom was Israel. But within 30 to 50 years after the two kingdoms were established, the northern kingdom's name was no longer Israel, but Ephraim, Israel, for the sake of clarity. And this was because Ephraim was the dominant tribe of the ten that occupied that northern portion of the promised land. Now, last week, we followed primarily the progression of kings of the southern kingdom of Judah, because Jerusalem, and therefore the temple, was in their jurisdiction. Now, we really didn't address the kings of the northern kingdom except for minor mention in explaining that they generally shunned the Jerusalem temple. Instead, they established two worship centers for themselves, one far up to the north in the city of Dan, another one in their southern territorial edge at Bethel. In fact, they also continued in a steady disillusion of their relationship with Jehovah by instituting calf worship, intermixing Baal worship with Jehovah worship, and setting up an alternative and biblically unauthorized priesthood. Now, Rehoboam was the first king of Judah. Jeroboam, the first king of Israel, immediately following the civil war after Solomon's death about 925 BC. Our temple journey from our last lesson took us up to the time of Ahaz, king of Judah, who began his rule about 740 BC. So we've covered almost two centuries in time since the original building of Solomon's temple. Ahaz ruled for 17 years. He was one of the worst, most evil kings Judah ever had known. His desecration of the temple was without conscience and probably unrivaled up to that point. Rather than review what he did, it can probably best be summed up with a few verses taken from the book of 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles. In 2 Kings 16, 17 through 18, we read this. King Ahaz removed the panels of the trolleys and took the basins off of them. He took the sea, the molten sea, off the bronze oxen supporting it and set it down on the stone pavement. And because the king of Asher, Assyria, he removed from the house of Adonai the colonnade used on Shabbat that had been built for it and for the king's entranceway outside of it. Also in 2 Chronicles, we're told this about Ahaz and his effect upon Israel. In 2 Chronicles 28, 20 through 25, Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Asher, Syria, attacked and besieged Ahaz instead of strengthening him. Even though Ahaz had stripped the house of Adonai and the palaces of the king and the princes and given that plunder to the king of Asher, it didn't help him at all. During his time of distress, the same King Ahaz added to his treachery against Adonai by sacrificing to the gods of Damascus, who had attacked him, reasoning, well, the gods of the kings of Aram helped them, so I'll sacrifice to them and maybe they'll help me. But they became the ruin of him and of all Israel. Ahaz collected the equipment from the house of God, broke to pieces the equipment from the house of God, sealed the doors of the house of Adonai, and then he made himself altars in every corner of Jerusalem. In every city of Judah, he made high places for offering to other gods, thus provoking Adonai, the God of his ancestors. Now, I ask you to take what has happened here to heart. Notice how the entire kingdom of Judah suffered because of one unusually bad leader, who on the one hand insisted that he was a true worshiper of the God of Israel, but on the other mixed the worship of other gods in his worship of Jehovah. He saw no inconsistencies with breaking down the God-ordained institutions established by Jehovah, and instead instituting what he saw as a modern and enlightened way to practice the religion of his ancestors. And he did this because he was certain that he and presumably the citizens of Judah would benefit by being tolerant and inclusive and adapting to the new geopolitical realities of the region. You know? It probably made political and economic sense to him to take this path. But in a relatively short time, it proved ruinous for the nation and people of Judah. In fact, in a final act of rebellious defiance towards the Lord, Ahaz closed the doors to the temple and he stopped its vital services. But his son, Hezekiah, followed him and set about to make the temple operational again. So Hezekiah began his rule now over Judah in about 725 BC, about the same time that the northern kingdom of Ephraim, Israel, was in process of being conquered by Assyria. Now, I want to be clear on this because the historical context is critical to our understanding Holy Scripture and much prophecy that has yet to play out. From this point forward. Now, part of the reason that Hezekiah's father Ahaz was so accommodating to the Assyrian king Tiglath-Pileser was because the Assyrian empire was enormous. It was growing. It was virtually unstoppable and had already put the northern kingdom of Ephraim, Israel, under siege. Ahaz, king of Judah, saw what was happening all around him, and he figured it was better to switch than fight. So he tried to fashion a vassal relationship with Assyria that would allow him to remain in power and Judah to remain a Hebrew nation. Now, it is usually said in historical textbooks that the northern kingdom of Ephraim Israel was conquered in 722 BC, about the third year of Hezekiah's reign. But in reality, that's merely when the final stronghold of the northern kingdom, which was Shomron, Samaria, the capital city, fell to Tiglath-Pileser's armies. The northern kingdom had been under assault by the Assyrians for at least a decade before that happened. And tribal region by tribal region, the 10 northern Israelite tribes that populated that area were deported to faraway lands and scattered all over the vast Assyrian Empire. This is where the legend of the 10 lost tribes of Israel was born. And the only real inaccuracy of that so-called legend is when we add the word lost to its title. These people were never lost to themselves, except spiritually speaking, maybe. Their exile was the result of their own desire to give up their Hebrew heritage, their Hebrew God, and instead adopt the ways and gods of their Gentile neighbors. These 10 tribes in exile knew exactly who they were, and many of them have doggedly maintained their tribal identities right up until today. Now, sadly, the vast bulk of those tribal members, however, lost their identities as they just melded their genes with the many people and races of the Gentile world. Therefore, understand, this was the difficult situation that King Ahaz operated under. Now, so did his son and the new king, Hezekiah. They were basically trying to survive as a tribe and as a nation of Hebrews and hoping to remain in the land. And they did so by submitting to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria. And this submission involved accepting great societal changes and even further intentional intermixing of the worship of the Assyrian gods with the worship of Yahweh. Now, we see this same process happening in modern times. In Europe, as the leaders of nation after nation there move to distance themselves from what little remains of their Christian heritage so that they can appease the violent onslaught of the Muslim religion in what is to them just a pragmatic political accommodation in order for their nations to survive and for their leaders to remain in power. And naturally, it involves tremendous social and financial upheaval, a watering down or even an abandonment of traditional morals and ways of life, and an all-encompassing religious and cultural tolerance that is advertised as modern intellectual enlightenment and religious freedom. And it is this new enlightenment and religious tolerance that forms the rationale for the enormous changes that are underway in European society. That is really nothing but raising the white flag of surrender to Islam. And despite what American leadership might say publicly, the United States is on the same path. We're just a few years behind Europe, is all. And the recognition of this danger by the USA citizenry is why such movements as the Tea Party spontaneously sprang to life. It's also why there's a growing protest and an uprising of evangelical Christians from years of passivity and silence, as well as a swelling chasm between evangelical Christians and denominations who on the one side want to embrace this new enlightenment and religious tolerance, but on the other side want to rediscover and return to the biblical ways of old. It is this seeking to reform Christianity back to a fundamentally biblically based faith values, morals, that's at the core of a Hebrew roots Christianity. And I tell you all this as both a context for Ahaz's and Hezekiah's reigns, and I tell you as a warning. The outcome of embracing religious tolerance as a philosophy and making a pact with the pagans was not what those ancient Jewish leaders hoped that all their compromising with other religions and nations would bring. And in our time, the outcome of the Judeo-Christian institution's insistent march towards religious tolerance and inclusiveness will not be what the modern church or synagogue or even political leaders hope for either. Rather, the result is going to be the destruction of the Judeo-Christian ethic and social order that's been the firm foundation of the Western world for well over a millennia, even though some modern religious and political leaders regularly deny that it's ever existed. Further, with the help of an expanding crowd of heretical and anti-Semite Christian leaders, this new era of enlightenment and tolerance is going to deceive countless numbers of worshipers of Christ into adopting new ways that are abominable from the Lord's perspective. And it will inevitably lead to ruin. It will bring a severe response from the Lord. Now, does this sound like a fire and brimstone, all hell is about to break loose message? I hope it does, because that's what it is. I hope it is. See, history's cyclical. Solomon so wisely noted, there's nothing new under the sun. We've all witnessed this before. And these ancient Hebrew records called the Bible weren't left for us to merely read them like a compelling novel. They're not here for us to only intellectually learn about what Israel did and what terrible result followed. But rather, they're there to show us as God's worshipers what happens when we follow that same path as it's currently happening, then denying it and denouncing all who would dare to even point it out to us, and then to remind us what can be the only possible outcome. Hezekiah's first act as the new king of Judah was to reopen those temple doors. The temple was so badly damaged under the previous administration that structural repairs had to be made before any kind of cosmetic restoration could be undertaken. Simply clearing the interior of the Hekal, the temple, of trash and debris took a large team of priests a full week, we're told. Then they set about trying to recover as many of the precious vessels and ritual instruments as possible. Some of them had to be remade or repurchased. And after the refurbishment was largely completed, Hezekiah ordered a rededication ceremony, and then the vital temple functions restarted. The first celebration after that rededication was Pesach, Passover. Hezekiah also ordered that the many bamot, high places that had been constructed all over Jerusalem, and then later all over Judah, were to be destroyed. He even ventured up into the northern kingdom's territory and tore down some of their altars. But Hezekiah will be equally remembered for enlarging the Temple Mount until it formed the shape of a square about 800 feet on a side. More buildings were added to the temple complex. A water tunnel was dug through sheer rock to the pool of Siloam under the city of David to help protect Jerusalem's water supply. And in fact, one can walk inside that water tunnel today, and many of you will in a few weeks. However, in the 14th year of Hezekiah's reign, the latest in the line of kings of Assyria, Sennacherib, came down to Judah and he attacked, and he gained control over a number of Judean cities. This, of course, was meant as a message to Hezekiah, and it served his purpose. Hezekiah, in turn, paid a large bribe to Sennacherib in order for Hezekiah to remain king and for Judah to remain intact as a Hebrew nation. 2 Kings 18:16. It was at that time that Hizkiyahu, Hezekiah, stripped the gold from the doors of the sanctuary of Adonai and from the doorposts, which Hezekiah, king of Judah himself, had overlaid, and he gave it to the king of Asher. What we see thus far, then, in the temple saga is a cycle of the temple being looted, then restored, damaged, then refurbished, but also of it being heavily remodeled and then added on to. In fact, many experts believe that during the first temple period that was 4 centuries long, the holy complex had undergone so many changes and repairs due to looting and earthquakes and attacks from foreign enemies and simply normal repairs caused by time and weathering that the temple that the Babylonians eventually destroyed was unrecognizable from the one that Shlomo had originally built. Some claim that is what accounts for the differences that we see in the description of the temple in 1 Kings verses 6 and 7, verses 2 Chronicles 3 and 4. That is, these are descriptions from two different eras, as opposed to what many other scholars say are just copyist errors. Now, as Hezekiah grew older, his son Manasseh ruled alongside of him, very similar to how it was with David and his son Solomon for a while. However, upon his father's death in 686 BC, Manasseh set about to backslide and to reverse all the reforms his father had accomplished. He went so far as to build altars to the stars, the sun, the moon, in the temple. And he even set up an Asherah there. The priests, no doubt fearing that King Manasseh would ultimately desecrate the Holy of Holies, well, they removed the Ark of the Covenant from under the wings of those giant cherubim, and they hid it for many years, so the king couldn't get to it. And after being hauled off to Assyria for a time, for not being loyal enough to his foreign masters, King Manasseh returned and removed at least some of the pagan altars he had ordered built. At the same time, he repaired or rebuilt the great altar of burnt offering, meaning that even it had been defaced and ruined during his reign. Now Manasseh's son, Amon, followed him, but he was quickly murdered by his own servants. Amon's son, Josiah, was next, and he began his reign at the tender age of 8 years old. At the age of 16, however, he began to diligently seek the God of Israel. And within a few years, he began a series of reforms, and we read all about them in 2 Chronicles chapter 34. Here's just a sample. 2 Chronicles 34, starting at verse 1. Josiah was 8 years old when he began his reign, and he ruled for 31 years in Jerusalem. He did what was right from Adonai's perspective, living entirely in the manner of David his ancestor and turning away neither to the right nor the left. For in the 8th year of his reign, when he was still young, in other words, he had only been 16, he began seeking after the God of David his father. And in the 12th year, he began cleansing Judah and Jerusalem from all the high places, the sacred poles, the carved and cast metal images. In his presence, they broke down the altars of the Baalim, the Baals. He chopped down the pillars for sun worship that was mounted above them. He smashed the sacred poles and the carved and cast metal images, grinding them to dust, which he threw on the graves of those who had sacrificed to them. He burned the bones of the priests on their altars, thus cleansing Judah and Jerusalem. He did likewise in the cities of Manasseh and Ephraim and Shimon, even as far as Naphtali and their surrounding ruins. He broke down the altars. He beat the sacred poles and carved images to powder, and he chopped down the pillars for sun worship throughout all the land of Israel. Then he returned to Jerusalem. It was during the renewal and restoration of the temple at Josiah's command that the current high priest Hilkiah made a startling discovery. In the midst of all that debris, he found the book of the law, which for that era was considered what we call today Deuteronomy. No doubt it was somewhere inside the Holy of Holies. And that is why it was the high priest who discovered the scroll, because only he could enter that chamber. Apparently, even though the ark had been removed some years earlier to save it from being desecrated by that evil king Manasseh, the Deuteronomy scroll had been left behind. Now recall that the book of the law, Deuteronomy, was placed outside of the ark, not inside the stone with the stone tablets from Mount Sinai, so it would not have gone with the ark into hiding. So now Josiah took his turn in history at rebuilding the temple, and once it was completed, he ordered that the ark be returned to its rightful place in the Holy of Holies. And this is the point at which the mystery of the whereabouts of the Ark of the Covenant actually begins. Because this is the last time that we will hear of the Ark of the Covenant until the prophet Jeremiah's statement in Jeremiah 3 that indicates that the Ark is gone from the temple and its whereabouts are unknown. And yet Jeremiah says that at some future time, when all the nations of the world call Jerusalem the throne of God, then it shall be rediscovered. I want to comment here. I'm not about to get into the currently unsolvable debate over the modern location of the Ark of the Covenant. Some claim the Vatican has it. Others say it's in Ethiopia. Still others say it's buried under the Temple Mount. Some insist that it was destroyed. I'm going to say this much. While I don't have a strong opinion on where it is, I do strongly believe it was not destroyed. And it exists just as it was originally made during the days of Moses. There is no hint whatsoever in the Bible that it was destroyed. There is no extra biblical documentation that claims its demise. And it is self-evident that if any writer of the Bible had sufficient evidence that the Ark of the Covenant didn't exist any longer, certainly they would have spoken of it. The ritual furnishings of the temple had been damaged and looted or destroyed and then replaced several times over. So if a Hebrew leader actually thought that the Ark of the Covenant was permanently gone, it's hard to imagine they didn't just fashion a new one. Ever since the Babylonian exile, there was and remains an unshakable belief that the Ark of the Covenant is intact and hidden somewhere. I don't think we're far away from it resurfacing, if the prophecy of Jeremiah 3 is being correctly interpreted. Well, poor King Josiah, started out at 8 years old as king, was killed in 609 AD, as he naively tried to stand against Pharaoh Necho of Egypt, who merely wanted to march his army through Judah on his way further north to war against Assyria. Because Josiah stubbornly refused and then needlessly wounded Pharaoh's army, Necho retaliated by subjugating Judah, and he appointed a fellow named Jehoiakim as a vassal king over Judah. A few years later, King Nebuchadnezzar fought the Egyptian army and he defeated them. And then around 606 BC, he invaded Judah. Jehoiakim quickly switched loyalties from Egypt to Babylon. So he was allowed to remain the king. However, he chafed at Babylonian rule, and in a short-lived revolution, he was killed. in 598 BC. Well, Jehoiakim was replaced by Jehoiachin. He lasted only a few months. When he, along with a large amount of temple treasure, thousands of his fellow Judahites, they were all hauled off to Babylon as prisoners. Zedekiah replaced Jehoiachin. He was the last king of Judah. He too chafed at the rule and demands of the Babylonians. So Nebuchadnezzar's armies came down and completely destroyed Jerusalem and the temple in 586 BC. Nothing was left of it. The temple would not begin to be rebuilt from the ground up in any form until 536 BC. It would not be completed until 515 BC. And even then, it would go through many more improvements, degradations, followed by expansions, some more desecrations, more redesigns, until Herod built the most magnificent temple complex ever created on Mount Moriah. Now we're going to stop here in our temple saga, because the final point I want to make is this. There are interminable arguments and debates about whether the temple destroyed by the Babylonians should even be considered Solomon's temple, due to everything that had happened to it by then. And if the terribly modest replacement temple built after the Babylonian captivity ought to be thought of as the second temple. And if indeed it was the second temple, should Herod's temple then be considered the third temple, or should it be considered as a remodel and just an expansion of the second? And so, will the prophesied temple of modern times be the fourth temple or the third temple? Oh, these are the arguments that go on every day. The bottom line is, nothing is very nice and neat in Bible history, nor in Bible prophecy. If we're going to have an intellectually honest study of the Bible, and then an equally intellectually honest discussion of its meaning and application, then we have to realize we don't have all the answers supplied to us by God's Word about what happened in the past and what's going to happen in the future. But even more, we certainly can't reasonably expect to understand Bible history from only the New Testament. Nor can we expect to have a reasonable understanding of what lay ahead of us prophetically from only the Old Testament. And some of the rigid interpretations that pass for truth today within Christianity are really little more than speculations that support personal agendas. And this is in order for denominations to have something to differentiate themselves one from the other. For pastors and teachers to create followings. Sometimes to generate lucrative book sales. And what we also see is that Solomon's creative interpretation of what a proper temple to God ought to look like from the viewpoint of a Hebrew society in 960 BC is very different from that of the Israelites of 800 BC, then 700 BC, then 600 BC, and then in the early 500s BC. Herod's temple, built about 20 years before Yeshua's birth, envisioned it in yet another way. As does, by the way, Ezekiel's millennial temple that is yet to come. The next temple that will soon displace that ungodly golden dome shrine of Islam on the Temple Mount will no doubt look somewhat different than all those built from the past. If any of us are fortunate enough to witness the next temple constructed on Mount Moriah, hold on lightly to your personal visions of what it's going to look like, because I doubt it's going to be anything like it at all. And remember, other than for the requirement of an inner and an outermost chamber, the Holy of Holies and the Holy Place, not much else structurally matters. It is mankind, Jews and Christians, who seem to have a lot of emotional investment in the idea of exactly how a temple for Jehovah ought to be constructed. Because as God told David 3,000 years ago, He's not impressed. He's not concerned with fancy buildings. Remember, he said he was perfectly happy with a tent for his earthly dwelling place. Well, as I promised you at the beginning, let's get started on 1 Kings chapter 8 and the dedication ceremony of Solomon's temple. Now, I will warn you, this is a very long chapter. So I want to approach this by today reading it from start to finish, and then spending just a few moments to give you some general information about it. Then the next week, we'll start to revisit it, but we're going to do it in sections, rereading pieces of it as we go along. So open your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 8. 1 Kings chapter 8, if you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 377. First Kings chapter 8. Then Shlomo assembled all the leaders of Israel, all the heads of the tribes and the chiefs of the paternal clans of the people of Israel, to King Shlomo in Jerusalem to bring the Ark of the Covenant of Adonai out of the city of David, also known as Zion. All the men of Israel assembled before King Solomon at the festival in the month of Etanim, the seventh month. All the leaders of Israel came. The priests took the ark, and they brought up the ark of God, the tent of meeting, and all the holy utensils that were in the tent. These are what the Kohanim and Levi'im, priests and Levites, brought up. King Shlomo and the whole community of Israel assembled in his presence. They were with him in front of the ark, sacrificing sheep and oxen in numbers beyond counting or recording. The priests brought the ark for the covenant of Adonai into its place inside the sanctuary of the house, to the especially holy place under the wings of the Karuvim, the cherubim. For the cherubim spread out their wings over the place of the ark, covering the ark and its poles from above. The poles were so long that their ends could be seen from the holy place in front of the sanctuary, but they could not be seen from outside. They are there to this day. There was nothing in the ark except the two tablets of stone, which Moses put there at Horeb, when Adonai made the covenant with the people of Israel at the time of their leaving the land of Egypt. And when the priests came out of the holy place, the cloud filled the house of Adonai, so that because of the cloud, the priests could not stand up to perform their service, for the glory of Adonai filled the house of Adonai. And Shlomo said, Adonai said he would live in thick darkness, but I have built you a magnificent house, a place where you can live forever. Then the king turned around and he blessed the whole community of Israel. And the whole community of Israel stood as he said, Blessed be Adonai, the God of Israel, who spoke to my father David with his mouth and fulfilled his promise with his hand. And he said, Since the day I brought my people Israel out of Egypt, I chose no city from any of the tribes of Israel in which to build a house so that my name might be there. But I did choose David to be over my people Israel. Now, it was in the heart of David, my father, to build a house for the name of Adonai, the God of Israel. But Adonai said to David, my father, although it was in your heart to build a house for my name, and you did well that it was in your heart, nevertheless, you will not build the house. Rather, you will father a son, and it will be he who will build the house for my name. Now Adonai has fulfilled this spoken word of his. For I have succeeded my father, and I sit on the throne of Israel, as Adonai promised, and I have built the house for the name of Adonai, the God of Israel. And there I have made a place for the ark containing the covenant of Adonai, which he made with our ancestors when he brought them out of the land of Egypt. Then Solomon stood before the altar of Adonai in the presence of the whole community of Israel and spread out his hands towards heaven. And he said, Adonai, God of Israel, there is no God like you in heaven above or on earth below. You keep covenant with your servants and you show them grace, provided they live in your presence with all their heart. You have kept your promise to your servant David, my father. You spoke with your mouth and fulfilled it with your hand, so it is today. Now therefore, Adonai, God of Israel, keep what you promised to your servant David, my father, when you said, You will never lack a man in my presence to sit on the throne of Israel. If only your children are careful about what they do, so that they live in my presence just as you have lived in my presence. Now, therefore, God of Israel, please let your word which you spoke to your servant David, my father, be confirmed. But can God actually live on earth? Why, heaven itself, even the heaven of heavens, cannot contain you. So how much less this house I've built? Even so, Adonai, my God, pay attention to your servant's prayer and plea. Listen to the cry and prayer that your servant is praying before you today, that your eyes will be open towards this house night and day, towards the place concerning which you said, my name will be there. In order to listen to the prayer your servant will pray towards this place. Yes, listen to the pleas of your servant, also to that of your people, Israel, when they pray towards this place, here in heaven where you live. And when you hear, forgive. If a person sins against a fellow member of the community and he is made to swear under oath, and he comes and swears before your altar in this house, then hear in heaven and act and judge your servants. Condemn the wicked so that this way of life devolves on his own head, vindicating the one who is right, giving him what his righteousness deserves. When your people Israel sin against you and in consequence are defeated by an enemy, then if they turn back to you, acknowledge your name and pray and make their plea to you in this house. Here in heaven, forgive the sin of your people, Israel. Bring them back to the land you gave their ancestors. When they sin against you and in consequence the sky is shut so that there is no rain, then if they pray towards this place, acknowledge your name and turn from their sin when you have brought them low, here in heaven, forgive the sin of your servants and your people Israel, since you keep teaching them the good way which they should live, and send down rain on your land which you have given your people as their inheritance. If there's famine in the land, or blight, or windstorm, mildew, locusts, or shearer worms, or if their enemy comes to the land and besieges them in any of their cities, no matter what kind of plague or sickness it is, then regardless of what prayer or plea anyone among all of your people Israel makes, for each individual will know what is plaguing his own conscience. And the person spreads out his hands towards this house, here in heaven where you live, and forgive and act. And since you know what is in each one's heart, give each person what his conduct deserves, because you and only you know all human hearts, so that they will fear you throughout the time they live in the land you gave our ancestors. Also, the foreigner who does not belong to your people Israel, when he comes from a distant country because of your reputation, for they will hear of your great reputation, your mighty hand, and your outstretched arm. When he comes and prays towards this house, then hear in heaven where you live and act in accordance with everything about which the foreigner is calling to you, so that all the peoples of the earth will know your name and fear you, as does your people Israel, so that they will know that this house which I have built bears your name. If your people go out to fight against their enemy, no matter by which way you send them, and they pray to Adonai towards the city you chose, towards the house I built for your name, then in heaven, hear their prayer, their plea, uphold their cause. If they sin against you, for there is no one who doesn't sin, and you're angry with them, and you hand them over to the enemy, so that they carry them off captive to the land of their enemy, whether far away or nearby, then if they come to their senses in the land where they've been carried away captive, they turn back. They make their plea to you in the land of those who carried them off captive, saying, we have sinned, we acted wrongly, we behaved wickedly. If in the land of their enemies who carried them off captive, they return to you with all their heart and being, and they pray to you toward their own land, which you gave to their ancestors, towards the city you chose, toward the house I have built for your name, then in heaven where you live, hear their prayer and plea. Uphold their cause. Forgive your people who have sinned against you. Forgive their transgressions which they have committed against you. And give them compassion in the sight of their captors, so that they will show compassion towards them. For they are your people, your inheritance, whom you brought out of Egypt, out of the flames of the iron furnace. May your eyes be open to the plea of your servant, to the plea of your people Israel, so that you will hear them wherever, whenever they cry out to you. For you made a distinction between them and all the peoples of the earth by making them your inheritance. And you said through Moses, your servant, when you brought out our ancestors out of Egypt, Adonai Elohim. When Shlomo had finished praying all of this prayer and plea to Adonai, he got up from in front of the altar of Adonai where he had been kneeling with his hands spread out towards heaven, and he stood up and he raised his voice to bless the whole community of Israel. And he said, blessed be Adonai who has given rest to his people Israel in accordance with everything he promised. Not one word has failed of his good promise, which he made through Moses his servant. May Adonai our God be with us as he was with our ancestors. May he never leave us or abandon us. In this way he will incline our hearts towards him, so that we will live according to his ways, observe his commandments and laws and rulings which he ordered our fathers to obey. May these words of mine, which I have used in my plea before Adonai, be present with Adonai our God day and night, so that he will uphold the cause of his servant and the cause of his people Israel day by day. Then all the peoples of the earth will know that Adonai is God, there is no other. So be wholehearted with Adonai our God, living by his laws, observing his mitzvot, his commandments, as you are doing today. And then the king, together with all Israel, offered sacrifices before Adonai. For the sacrifice of peace offerings which Shlomo offered to Adonai, he offered 22,000 oxen, 120,000 sheep. Thus the king and all the people of Israel dedicated the house of Adonai. That same day, the king consecrated the center of the courtyard in front of the house of Adonai because he had to offer the burnt offering, the grain offering, and the fat of the peace offerings there. For the bronze altar before Adonai was too small to receive the burnt offering, the grain offering, and the fat of the peace offering. So Shlomo celebrated the festival at that time. All Israel, a huge gathering that had come all the way from the entrance to Hamath to the Wadi of Egypt, celebrated with him before Adonai our God for 7 days, and then for 7 more days, 14 days in all. On the 8th day, he sent the people away. They blessed the king, and they returned to their tents full of joy, glad of heart, for all the goodness Adonai had shown to David, his servant, and to Israel, his people. What a magnificent chapter. This long chapter can be viewed as being in 3 parts. First, the bringing of the ark, the remnants of the wilderness tabernacle, and the various ritual vessels to the temple that was now atop Mount Moriah. Second of all, Solomon's prayer of temple dedication. And third, the blessings of the congregation of Israel and the many sacrifices that will initiate now the temple services. There's also a brief mention of another event, and that is the celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles, Sukkot, that takes place in conjunction with the temple dedication ceremony. Now, the most interesting and I think controversial aspect of the opening couple of verses is when the temple dedication ceremony took place. Notice that we're told that it happened in the 7th month. However, if we go to 1 Kings chapter 6, go back in it, we read this. The foundation of the house of Adonai was laid in the 4th year in the month of Ziv. In the 11th year, in the month of Bul, which is the 8th month, all parts of the house were completed as exactly as designed. Thus, he was 7 years building it. So, the temple was finished, we're told here, in the 8th month, but the dedication is said to have been performed in the 7th month. First, let me mention that the 7th month is called Etanim in 1 Kings 8, which is not a Hebrew word. Etanim is Phoenician, and it means something like endurance or strengthen. Now, why was a Phoenician word for the month used here? Well, probably because Hiram was a Phoenician king and his involvement in the building of the temple was so crucial. So this was likely for the purpose of honoring the Phoenicians and their king for their generosity and participation in the temple construction. Etanim, the seventh month, is today called Tishri. Now for the problem of the timing. There is no other reasonable explanation than that there was an 11-month delay from the official day of completion of the temple to the official day of its dedication. Some scholars try to say that it actually didn't happen for several years until after Solomon completed his own palace complex, because we read about the building of Solomon's palace prior to the reading of the temple dedication. That simply defies common sense. And as we've discussed, the Bible doesn't operate in strict chronological sequence. Solomon wouldn't rush to build a grand temple, outfit it entirely, and then let it sit there dormant for 13 years. There is no evidence that Solomon saw any kind of a temporal connection between the temple and his palace that could account for a 13-year wait. But why would he wait even an 11-month period to dedicate the temple and start to use it? You know, it's actually not hard to understand if one knows the Torah. The seventh month is a very special holiday month in the Hebrew religious calendar because the three fall feasts occur then, as ordained by God. The feast of Yom Teruah, today it's called Rosh Hashanah, that happens on the first day of the month. The feast of Yom Kippur, that happens on the 10th day of the month. And then finally, the feast of Sukkot, that begins on the 15th day of the month and lasts for 8 days. The key to understanding why this exact time was chosen to dedicate the temple is not contained in the festival that is the more obvious one in this chapter, Sukkot. Rather, it's because of Yom Kippur. The issue was that the Ark of the Covenant had to be placed into the newly built Holy of Holies in order for the temple to become functional. But only one person, the high priest, was authorized to enter that chamber, and just as importantly, on only one day of the year, Yom Kippur. So the temple couldn't be dedicated and anointed unless the Ark was in the Holy of Holies, but that couldn't happen except on the 10th day of the seventh month of the year, Yom Kippur. So the wait of 11 months from the date of the temple's completion to the date it could be dedicated was so that the next Yom Kippur could arrive. And so the high priest could enter the Holy of Holies to place the Ark of the Covenant there. We'll continue with chapter 8 next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.